2016, revelou que a substância ilícita presente no sangue é, afinal, Nuno Rogeiro.
A Escola da Noite apresenta...
Quando o Hulk era só cavalo?
Hulk, boa demais para existir.
Noite de sábado é a altura de Preto no Branco, na Rádio Universidade de Coimbra. 2 horas de rádio com absoluta nitidez. Nesta emissão de 4 de dezembro. Fiquem desse lado para conhecer melhor a história da Escócia, cujo hino nacional ouvimos já de fundo, Flowers of Scotland. Por aqui vamos hoje intercalar a leitura da obra A Short History of Scotland, com alguns temas de bandas nativas daquele país. Fica então desse lado, com o Preto no Branco, até à meia-noite. Alinhamento completo pode ser consultado em pretonobrancoruc.blogspot.com. Verifiquem lá todos os temas que vamos ouvir por aqui, bem como detalhes da obra A Short History of Scotland. Tenham então uma boa noite com a RUC.
A Short History of Scotland by Andrew Lang. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Chapter 1. Scotland and the Romans. If we could see in a magic mirror the country now called Scotland, as it was when the Romans, under Agricola, 81 AD, crossed the border, we would recognize little but the familiar hills and mountains. The rivers in the plains overflowed their present banks. Dense forests of oak and pine, haunted by great red deer, elks, and boars, covered the land that has long been arable. There were lakes and lagoons where for centuries there have been fields of corn. On the oldest sites of our towns were groups of huts made of clay and wattle, and dominated, perhaps, by the large stockaded house of the tribal prince. In the lochs, natural islands or artificial islets made of piles, crannogs, afforded standing ground and protection to villages, if indeed these lake dwellings are earlier in Scotland than the age of war that followed the withdrawal of the Romans. The natives were far beyond the savage stage of culture. They lived in an age of iron tools and weapons and of wheeled vehicles, and were in what is called the late Celtic condition of art and culture, familiar to us from beautiful objects in bronze work, more commonly found in Ireland than in Scotland, and from the oldest Irish romances and poems. In these epics, the manners much resemble those described by Homer. Like his heroes, the men in the Cuchulainn sagas fight from light chariots, drawn by two ponies, and we know that so fought the tribes in Scotland encountered by Agricola, the Roman general, 81 to 85 AD. It is even said in the Irish epics that Cuchulainn learned his chariotry in Alba, that is, in our Scotland. The warriors had mighty limbs and flaming hair, says Tacitus. Their weapons were heavy iron swords, in bronze sheaths beautifully decorated, and iron-headed spears. They had large, round, bronze-studded shields and battle axes. The dress consisted of two upper garments. First, the smock of linen or other fabric, in battle, often of tanned hides of animals, and the mantle or plaid with its brooch. Golden torques and heavy gold bracelets were worn by the chiefs. The women had bronze ornaments with brightly colored enameled decoration. Agriculture was practiced, and corn was ground in the circular querns of stone, of which the use so long survived. The women span and wove the gay smocks and darker cloaks of the warriors. Of their religion, we only know that it was a form of polytheism, that sacrifices were made, and that druids existed. They were soothsayers, magicians, perhaps priests, and were attendant on kings. Such were the people in Alba whom we can dimly descry around Agricola's fortified frontier between the Firths of Forth and Clyde, about 81 to 82 AD. When Agricola pushed north of the Forth and Tay, he still met men who had considerable knowledge of the art of war. In his battle at Mons Graupius, perhaps at the junction of Isla and Tay, his cavalry had the better of the native chariotry in the plain, and the native infantry, descending from their position on the heights, were attacked by his horsemen in their attempt to assail his rear. But they were swift of foot. The woods sheltered and the hills defended them. He made no more effectual pursuit than Cumberland did at Culloden. Agricola was recalled by Domitian after 7 years' warfare, and his garrisons did not long hold their forts on his lines or frontier, which stretched across the country from Forth to Clyde, roughly speaking, from Graham's Dyke, east of Barrowstonis, on the Firth of Forth, to Old Kilpatrick on Clyde. The region is now full of coal mines, foundries, and villages, but excavations at Barheel, Castle Kerry, and Rough Castle disclose traces of Agricola's works, with their earthen ramparts. The Roman station at Camelin, northwest of Falkirk, was connected with the southern passes of the Highland Hills by a road with a chain of forts. The remains of Roman pottery at Camelon are of the 1st century. 2 generations after Agricola, about 140 to 145, the Roman governor, Lollius Urbicus, refortified the line of Forth to Clyde with a wall of sods and a ditch, and forts much larger than those constructed by Agricola. His line, the Antonine Vallum, had its works on commanding ridges, and fire signals, in case of attack by the natives, flashed the news from one sea to the other sea, while the troops of occupation could be provisioned from the Roman fleet. Judging by the coins found by the excavators, the line was abandoned about 190, and the forts were wrecked and dismantled, perhaps by the retreating Romans. After the retreat from the Antonine Vallum, about 190, we hear of the vigorous unrest of the Mete and Caledonians. The later people are said, on very poor authority, to have been little better than savages. Against them, Severus, 208, made an expedition indefinitely far to the north, but the enemy shunned a general engagement, cut off small detachments, and caused the Romans terrible losses in this march to a non-existent Moscow. Not till 306 do we hear of the Picts, about whom there is infinite learning but little knowledge. They must have spoken Gaelic by Severus's time, 208, whatever their original language, and were long recognized in Galloway, where the hill and river names are Gaelic. The later years of the Romans, who abandoned Britain in 410, were perturbed by attacks of the Scoti, Scots, from Ireland, and it is to a settlement in Argyll of Dalriadic, Scots from Ireland, about 500 AD, that our country owes the name of Scotland. Rome has left traces of her presence on Scottish soil, vestiges of the forts and vallum walls between the firths, a station rich in antiquities under the Idens at Newstead, another, Ardoch, near Sheriffmuir, a third near Solway Moss, Baron's Ark, and others less extensive, with some roads extending towards the Moray Firth, and a villa at Musselburgh, found in the reign of James VI.
Doesn't matter.
about 563, settled in Ionia, and converted the Picts as far north as Inverness, we owe the introduction of Christianity, for though the Roman Church of St. Ninian, at Withern in Galway, left embers of the faith not extinct near Glasgow, St. Kettigern's country, till Columba's time, the rites of Christian Scotland were partly of the Celtic-Irish type, even after St. Wilfrid's victory at the Synod of Whitby. St. Columba himself was of the royal line in Ulster, was learned, as learning was then reckoned, and if he had previously been turbulent, he now desired to spread the gospel. With 12 companions he settled in Ionia, established the cloister of cells, and journeyed to Inverness, the capital of Pictland. Here his miracles overcame the magic of the king's druids, and his majesty, Brude, came into the fold, his people following him. Columba was no less of a diplomatist than of an evangelist. In a crystal he saw revealed the name of the rightful king of the Dalriad Scots in Argyll, namely, Aidan, and in 575, at Drumsiet in North Ireland, he procured the recognition of Aidan, and brought the king of the Picts also to confess Aidan's independent royalty. In The Life of Columba, by Adam Nunn, we get a clear and complete view of everyday existence in the Highlands during that age. We are among the red deer and the salmon and the cattle in the hills, among the second-sighted men, too, of whom Columba was far the foremost. We see the saint's inkpot upset by a clumsy but enthusiastic convert. We even make acquaintance with the old white pony of the monastery, who mourned when St. Columba was dying, while among secular men we observe the differences in rank, measured by degrees of wealth in cattle. Many centuries elapsed before, in Froissart, we find a picture of Scotland so distinct as that painted by Adam Nunn. The discipline of St. Columba was of the monastic model. There were settlements of clerics and fortified villages. The clerics were a kind of monks, with more regard for abbots than for their many bishops, and with peculiar tonsures, and a peculiar way of reckoning the date of Easter. Each missionary was popularly called a saint, and the kill, or cell, of many a Celtic missionary survives in hundreds of place names. The saltwater Loch Leven in Argyll was on the west the south frontier of Pictland, which on the east included all the country north of the Firth of Forth. From Loch Leven south to Kintyre, a large cantle, including the Isles, was the land of the Scots from Ireland, the Dalriadic Kingdom. The southwest, from Dumbarton, including our modern Cumberland and Westmoreland, was named Strathclyde, and was peopled by British folk, speaking an ancient form of Welsh. On the east, from Ettrick Forest into Lothian, the land was part of the early English kingdom of Bernicia. Here the invading Angles were already settled, though river names here remain Gaelic, and hill names are often either Gaelic or Welsh. The great northern Pictland was divided into seven provinces, or sub-kingdoms, while there was an over-king, or Ardrigh, with his capital at Inverness, and later in Angus, or Forfarshire. The country about Edinburgh was partly English, partly Cymric or Welsh. The southwest corner, Galloway, was called Pictish, and was peopled by Gaelic-speaking tribes. In the course of time and events, the dynasty of the Argyll Scoti from Ireland gave its name to Scotland, while the English element gave its language to the lowlands. It was adopted by the Celtic kings of the whole country and became dominant, while the Celtic speech withdrew into the hills of the north and northwest. The nation was thus evolved out of alien and hostile elements, Irish, Pictish, Gaelic, Cymric, English, and on the northern and western shores, Scandinavian. The position towards France of Edward I made it really more desirable for him that Scotland should be independent and friendly than half-subdued and hostile to his rule. While she was hostile, England, in attacking France, always left an enemy in her rear. But Edward supposed that by clemency to all Scottish leaders except Wallace, by giving them great appointments and trusting them fully, and by calling them to his parliament in London, he could combine England and Scotland in affectionate union. He repaired the ruins of war in Scotland. He began to study her laws and customs. He hastily ran up for her a new constitution, and appointed his nephew, John of Brittany, as governor. But he had overlooked two facts. The Scottish clergy, from the highest to the lowest, were irreconcilably opposed to union with England, and the greatest and most warlike of the Scottish nobles, if not patriotic, were fickle and insatiably ambitious. It is hard to reckon how often Robert Bruce had turned his coat, and how often the Bishop of St. Andrews had taken the oath to Edward. Both men were in Edward's favor in June 1304, but in that month they made against him a treasonable secret covenant. Through 1305, Bruce prospered in Edward's service. On February 10, 1306, Edward was conferring on him a new favor, little guessing that Bruce, after some negotiation with his old rival, the Red Comyn, had slain him. An uncle of his was also butchered, before the high altar of the Church of the Franciscans in Dumfries. Apparently Bruce had tried to enlist Comyn in his conspiracy, and had found him recalcitrant, or feared that he would be treacherous. February 10, 1306. The sacrilegious homicide made it impossible for Bruce again to waver. He could not hope for pardon. He must be victorious or share the fate of Wallace. He summoned his adherents, including young James Douglas, received the support of the bishops of St. Andrews and Glasgow, hurried to Scone, and there was hastily crowned with a slight coronet, in the presence of but two earls and three bishops. Edward made vast warlike preparations and forswore leniency, while Bruce, under papal excommunication, which he slighted, collected a few nobles, such as Lennox, Athol, Errol, and a brother of the chief of the Frasers. Other chiefs, kinsmen of the slain Comyn, among them MacDowell of Argyll, banded to avenge the victim. Bruce's little force was defeated at Methven Wood, near Perth, by Aymer de Valence, and prisoners of all ranks were hanged as traitors, while two bishops were placed in irons. Bruce took to the heather, pursued by the MacDowells no less than by the English. His queen was captured, his brother Nigel was executed. He cut his way to the wild west coast, aided only by Sir Niall Candel of Loch Awe, who thus founded the fortune of his house, and by the MacDonalds, under Angus Og of Islay. He wintered in the Isle of Rathlin, some think he even went to Norway, and in spring, after surprising the English garrison in his own castle of Turnberry, he roamed, now lonely, now with a mobile little force in Galloway, always evading and sometimes defeating his English pursuers. At Loch Truil and at London Hill, Drumclog, he dealt them heavy blows, while on June 7, 1307, his great enemy Edward died at Burgh-on-Sands, leaving the crown and the war to the weakling Edward II. Fortune had turned. We cannot follow Bruce through his campaign in the north, where he ruined the country of the Comyns, 1308, and through the victories in Galloway of his hard-fighting brother Edward. With enemies on every side, Bruce took them in detail. Early in March 1309, he routed the MacDowells at the west end of the Pass of Brander. Edward II was involved in disputes with his own barons, and Bruce was recognized by his country's church in 1310, and aided by his great lieutenants, Sir James Douglas and Thomas Randolph, Earl of Murray. By August 1311, Bruce was carrying the war into England, sacking Durham and Chester, failing at Carlisle, but in January 1313 capturing Perth. In summer, Edward Bruce, in the spirit of chivalry, gave to Stirling Castle, Randolph had taken Edinburgh Castle, a set day, Midsummer Day 1314, to be relieved or to surrender, and Bruce kept his tryst with Edward II and his English and Irish levies, and all his adventurous chivalry from France, Hainault, Bretagne, Gascony, and Aquitaine. All the world knows the story of the first battle, the Scottish Quatre Bras, the success of Randolph on the right, the slaying of Bohun when Bruce broke his battle axe. Next day Bruce's position was strong. Beneath the towers of Stirling, the Bannockburn protected his front. Morasses, only to be crossed by narrow paths, impeded the English advance. Edward Bruce commanded the right wing, Randolph the center, Douglas and the steward the left, Bruce the reserve, the islesman. His strength lay in his spearmen's dark, impenetrable wood. His archers were ill-trained. Of horse he had but a handful near Keith, the marshal. But the heavy English cavalry could not break the squares of spears. Keith cut up the archers of England. The main body could not deploy, and the slow, relentless advance of the whole Scottish line covered the plain with the dying and the flying. A panic arose, caused by the sight of an approaching cloud of camp followers on the Gillies Hill. Edward fled, and hundreds of noble prisoners, with all the wagons and supplies of England, fell into the hands of the Scots. In 8 strenuous years, the generalship of Bruce and his war leaders, the resolution of the people, hardened by the cruelties of Edward, the sermons of the clergy, and the utter incompetence of Edward II, had redeemed desperate chance. From a fief of England, Scotland had become an indomitable nation. Later days of Bruce. Bruce continued to prosper, despite an ill-advised attempt to win Ireland, in which Edward Bruce fell, 1318. This left the succession, if Bruce had no male issue, to the children of his daughter, Marjorie, and her husband, the steward. In 1318, Scotland recovered Berwick. In 1319, routed the English at Mytton-on-Swale. In a parliament at Aberbrothock, April 6, 1320, the Scots announced to the Pope, who had been interfering, that while 100 of them survive, they will never yield to England. In October 1322, Bruce utterly routed the English at Byland Abbey, in the heart of Yorkshire, and chased Edward II into York. In March 1324, a son was born to Bruce named David. On May 4, 1328, by the Treaty of Northampton, the independence of Scotland was recognized. In July, the infant David married Joanna, daughter of Edward II. On June 7, 1329, Bruce died and was buried at Dunfermline. His heart, by his order, was carried by Douglas towards the Holy Land, and when Douglas fell in a battle with the Moors in Spain, the heart was brought back by Sir Simon Lockhart of the Lee. The later career of Bruce, after he had been excommunicated, is that of the foremost knight and most sagacious man of action who ever wore the crown of Scotland. The staunchness with which the clergy and estates disregarded papal fulminations, indeed, under William the Lion, they had treated an interdict as waste paper, indicated a kind of Protestant tendency to independence of the Holy See. Bruce's inclusion of representatives of the boroughs in the first regular Scottish Parliament, at Cambuskenneth in 1326, was a great step forward in the constitutional existence of the country. The king in Scotland was expected to live of his own, but in 1326 the expenses of the war with England compelled Bruce to seek permission for taxation. The Minority of Mary Stuart. When James died, Henry VIII seemed to hold in his hand all the winning cards in the game of which Scotland was the stake. He held Angus and his brother George Douglas. When he slipped them, they would again wield the whole force of their house in the interests of England and of Henry's religion. Moreover, he held many noble prisoners taken at Solway, Glencairn, Maxwell, Cassillis, Fleming, Grey, and others, and all of these, save Sir George Douglas, have not sticked, says Henry himself, to take upon them to set the crown of Scotland on our head. Henry's object was to get the child, the person of the cardinal, and of such as be chief hindrances to our purpose, and also the chief holds and fortresses into our hands. By sheer brigandage the reformer king hoped to succeed where the Edwards had failed. He took the oaths of his prisoners, making them swear to secure for him the child, Beaton, and the castles, and later released them to do his bidding. Henry's failure was due to the genius and resolution of Cardinal Beaton, heading the Catholic party. What occurred in Scotland on James's death is obscure. Later, Beaton was said to have made the dying king's hand subscribe a blank paper filled up by appointment of Beaton himself as one of a regency council of four or five. There is no evidence for the tale. What actually occurred was the proclamation of the earls of Arran, Argyll, Huntly, Moray, and Beaton as regents, December 19, 1542. Arran, the chief of the Hamiltons, was, we know, unless ousted by Henry VIII, the next heir to the throne after the newborn Mary. He was a good-hearted man, but the weakest of mortals, and his constant veerings from the Catholic and national to the English and reforming side were probably caused by his knowledge of his very doubtful legitimacy. Either party could bring up the doubt. Beaton, having the ear of the Pope, could be specially dangerous, but so could the opposite party, if once firmly seated in office. Arran, in any case, presently ousted the Archbishop of Glasgow from the chancellorship and gave the seals to Beaton, the man whom he presently accused of a shameless forgery of James's will. The regency soon came into Arran's own hands. The Solway Moss prisoners, learning this as they journeyed north, began to repent of their oaths of treachery, especially as their oaths were known or suspected in Scotland. George Douglas prevailed on Arran to seize and imprison Beaton till he answered certain charges, but no charges were ever made public, none were produced. The clergy refused to christen or bury during his captivity. Parliament met, March 12, 1543, and still there was silence as to the nature of the accusations against Beaton, and by March 22, George Douglas himself released the cardinal, of course for a consideration, and carried him to his own strong castle of St. Andrews. Parliament permitted the reading, but forbade the discussion of the Bible in English. Arran was posing as a kind of Protestant. Ambassadors were sent to Henry to negotiate a marriage between his son Edward and the baby queen, but Scotland would not give up a fortress, would never resign her independence, would not place Mary in Henry's hands, would never submit to any but a native ruler. The airy castle of Henry's hopes fell into dust, built as it was on the oaths of traitors. Love of such a religion as Henry professed, retaining the mass and making free use of the stake and the gibbet, was not, even to Protestants, so attractive as to make them run the English course and submit to the English Lord Paramount. Some time was needed to make Scots, whatever their religious opinions, lick the English rod. But the scale was soon to turn, for every reforming sermon was apt to produce the harrying of religious houses, and every punishment of the robbers was persecution intolerable, against which men sought English protection. Henry VIII now turned to Arran for support. To Arran he offered the hand of his daughter, the Princess Elizabeth, who should later marry the heir of the Hamiltons. But by mid-April Arran was under the influence of his bastard brother, the Abbot of Paisley, later Archbishop Hamilton. The Earl of Lennox, a Stuart and keeper of Dumbarton Castle, arrived from France. He was hostile to Arran, for if Arran were illegitimate, Lennox was next heir to the crown after Mary. He was thus, for the moment, the ally of Beaton against Arran. George Douglas visited Henry and returned with his terms, Mary to be handed over to England at the age of 10, and to marry Prince Edward at 12. Arran, by a prior arrangement, was to receive Scotland north of Forth, an auxiliary English army, and the hand of Elizabeth for his son. To the English contingent, Arran preferred £5,000 in ready money. That was his price. Sadler, Henry's envoy, saw Mary of Guise, and saw her little daughter unclothed. He admired the child, but could not disentangle the crosswebs of intrigue. The National Party, the Catholic Party, was strongest, because least disunited. When the Scottish ambassadors who went to Henry in spring returned, July 21st, the National Party seized Mary and carried her to Stirling, where they offered Aaron a meeting and, he said, the child queen's hand for his son. But Aaron's own partisans, Glencairn and Cassilis, told Sadler that he fabled freely. Representatives of both parties accepted Henry's terms, but delayed the ratification. Henry insisted that it should be ratified by August 24th, but on August 16th he seized 6 Scottish merchant ships. Though the treaty was ratified on August 25th, Aaron was compelled to insist on compensation for the ships, but on August 28th he proclaimed Beaton a traitor. In the beginning of September, Aaron favored the wrecking of the Franciscan monastery in Edinburgh, and at Dundee the mob, moved by sermons from the celebrated martyr George Wishart, did sack the houses of the Franciscans and the Dominicans. Beaton's Abbey of Arbroath and Abbey of Lindores were also plundered. Clearly it was believed that Beaton was down, and that church pillage was authorized by Aaron. Yet on September 3rd, Aaron joined hands with Beaton. The cardinal, by threatening to disprove Aaron's legitimacy and ruin his hopes of the crown, or in some other way had dominated the waverer, while Henry, August 29th, was mobilizing an army of 20,000 men for the invasion of Scotland. On September 9th, Mary was crowned at Stirling. But Beaton could not hold both Aaron and his rival Lennox, who committed an act of disgraceful treachery. With Glencairn, he seized large supplies of money and stores sent by France to Dumbarton Castle. In 1544, he fled to England and to the protection of Henry, and married Margaret, daughter of Angus and Margaret Tudor, widow of James IV. He became the father of Darnley, Mary's husband in later years, and the fortunes of Scotland were fatally involved in the feud between the Lennox Stuarts and the House of Hamilton. Meanwhile, November 1543, Aaron and Beaton together broke and persecuted the abbey robbers of Perthshire and Angus, making martyrs and incurring, on Beaton's part, fatal feuds with Leslies, Greys, Learmouths, and Kirkcaldys. Parliament, December 11th, declared the treaty with England void. The party of the Douglases, equally suspected by Henry and Beaton, was crushed, and George Douglas was held a hostage, still betraying his country in letters to England. Martyrs were burned in Perth and Dundee, which merely infuriated the populace. In April 1544, while Henry was giving the most cruel orders to his army of invasion, one Wishart visited him with offers, which were accepted, for the murder of the cardinal. Early in May the English army under Hartford took Leith, raised a jolly fire, says Hartford, in Edinburgh. He burned the towns on his line of march and retired. On May 17th, Lennox and Glencairn sold themselves to Henry. For ample rewards they were to secure the teaching of God's word, as the mere and only foundation whence proceeds all truth and honor. Aaron defeated Glencairn when he attempted his godly task, and Lennox was driven back into England. In June, Mary of Guise fell into the hands of nobles led by Angus, while the Fife, Perthshire, and Angus lairds, lately Beaton's deadly foes, came into the cardinal's party. With him and Aaron, in November, were banded the Protestants who were to be his murderers, while the Douglases, in December, were cleared by Parliament of all their offences, and Henry offered £3,000 for their trapping. Angus, in February 1545, protested that he loved Henry best of all men, and would make Lennox governor of Scotland, while Wharton for Henry was trying to kidnap Angus. Enraged by the English desecration of his ancestors' graves at Melrose Abbey, Angus united with Aaron, Norman Leslie, and Buccleuch to annihilate an English force at Ancram Moor, where Henry's men lost 800 slain and 2,000 prisoners. The loyalty of Angus to his country was now, by innocents like Aaron, thought assured. The plot for Beaton's murder was, in 1545, negotiated between Henry and Cassilis, backed by George Douglas, and Crichton of Bunsted, as before, was engaged a godly lord in Lothian. In August, the Douglases boast that, as Henry's friends, they have frustrated an invasion of England with a large French contingent, which they pretended to lead, while they secured its failure. Meanwhile, after 40 years, Donald Dubh and all the great Western chiefs, none of whom could write, renewed the old alliance of 1463 with England, calling themselves old enemies of Scotland. Their religious predilections, however, were not Protestant. They promised to destroy or reduce half of Scotland, and hailed Lennox as governor, as in Angus's offer to Henry in spring 1545. Lennox did make an attempt against Dumbarton in November with Donald Doubt. They failed, and Donald died, without legitimate issue, at Drogheda. The Macleans, Maclouds, and Macneils then came into the National Party. In September 1545, Hertford, with an English force, destroyed the religious houses at Melrose, Kelso, Dryburgh, and Jedburgh. Meanwhile, the two Douglases skulked with the murderous traitor Cassillis in Ayrshire, and Henry tried to induce French deserters from the Scottish flag to murder Beaton and Arran. Beaton could scarcely escape forever from so many plots. His capture in January 1546 of George Wishart, an eminently learned and virtuous Protestant preacher, and an intimate associate of the murderous, double-dyed traitor Brunston, and of other Lothian pietists of the English party, and his burning of Wishart at St. Andrews on March 1, 1546, sealed the cardinal's doom. On May 29th, he was surprised in his castle of St. Andrews and slain by his former ally, Norman Leslie, master of Roths, with Kirkcaldy of Grange and James Melville, who seems to have dealt the final stab after preaching at his powerless victim. They insulted the corpse and held St. Andrew's castle against all comers. How gallant a fight Beaton had waged against adversaries, how many and multifarious, how murderous, self-seeking, treacherous, and hypocritical, we have seen. He maintained the independence of Scotland against the most recklessly unscrupulous of assailants, though probably he was rather bent on defending the lost cause of a church entirely and intolerably corrupt. The two causes were at the moment inseparable, and whatever we may think of the Church of Rome, it was not more bloodily inclined than the church of which Henry was pope, while it was less illogical, not being the creature of a secular tyrant. If Henry and his party had won their game, the Church of Scotland would have been Henry's church, would have been Anglican. Thus it was Beaton who, by defeating Henry, made Presbyterian Calvinism possible in Scotland.
Universidade de Coimbra. Boa tarde.
É sim, eu sei como vocês da RUC são, por isso só vos tenho a dizer uma coisa. Ó Zé Paulo, estás a ouvir? Vem tomar café comigo amanhã à Vênus. Não sei se tu queres. Ou se por exemplo estás a hesitar, mas eu tenho muito a oferecer-te. Muito, muito. E tu sabes bem que sim.
Peço desculpa, mas não está no ar. Está a ligar para a secretaria.
Ai! Então como é que é? Sim ou não? Eu não tenho muito tempo a perder.
Não.